The Guardian.
Support for this podcast comes from Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes creating a professional website for your business, personal brand, or portfolio so easy, it's newsworthy. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
Hello, and welcome back to Science Weekly with me, Ian Sample. Coming up,
we live in an age of synthetic biology in which the emphasis, or the exciting part of science and biology, has shifted away from the reductionist, cut it apart, dissected apart analysis of individual cells, genes, proteins, and all that stuff, but rather putting it all together again. Aristotle's, that's the way he thinks.
Evolutionary biologist Armin Loire looks at the life and work of Aristotle and asks, were his groundbreaking methods of structuring the world the first stab at real science? Also on the show, we talk to the European Space Agency's Matt Taylor about the extraordinary journey of the Rosetta probe and the duck-like comet it's chasing around the sun. And we discuss the ethical issues connected with the experimental drugs that may have saved two US health workers from a fatal Ebola infection. And an aspirin a day keeps the cancer away. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. Joining me in the studio this week, I have Jessica Aldred, Deputy and Production Editor on the Guardian Environment Desk, Nicola Davis, Commissioning Editor and Writer on Observer Tech Monthly, and Nishad Karim, Physicist and the Guardian Science Desk Summer Intern. But first, we turn to the outbreak of the Ebola virus in West Africa. Just before we recorded the podcast, Margaret Chan, Director General of the World Health Organization, declared this outbreak, the largest and longest in history, an international public health emergency. To complicate an already difficult situation, last week the US evacuated two of its nationals who were infected health workers on the ground and gave them an experimental treatment that may have saved their lives. To discuss the ethical and medical complexity of this outbreak, I'm joined on the line by Professor Tom Solomon, Director of the Institute of Infection and Global Health at the University of Liverpool. Tom, the WHO are going to look at the ethical issues of giving these drugs in West Africa. What are the issues there?
Well, as you know, this is the largest outbreak of Ebola that we have ever seen. And in this outbreak, for the first time, some new experimental treatment has been used, raising questions about how we use drugs like this in outbreaks like this. And so this week, the WHO has convened a meeting of ethicists to consider all the ethical implications of how we go forwards.
What are the issues that they're going to have to wrestle with? Is it that, I mean, a lot of these drugs presumably would normally have gone through years and years of large clinical trials before they're properly approved for using in this condition?
Yes, I mean, the issue is this. We have an outbreak of a disease with a mortality which is up to 90%, and it's currently around 60%. And in these dire situations, then people want to use drugs on what's called a compassionate basis, which means using a drug that you think might work even though it's not been fully proven. And so what's happened so far is there's a drug called ZMapp that has been given to two Americans who survived and appeared to do well on it. But of course, if you just give a drug to two people and they get better, you never know, were they going to get better anyway? And in fact, these two looked like they were improving, or has the drug actually made a difference? So we're now in this situation where some people are saying, well, the drug might work, we should just use loads of it on everybody. And others are saying, are urging caution. My personal feeling is that the only way to take drugs like this forward is in the context of a clinical trial. But what we need to do, and I think this is where some of the ethical issues come in, is we have to ask ourselves, how do we get drugs like this to clinical trials as soon as possible?
When you talk about a clinical trial, do you mean a trial that's run over here, or do you mean a trial that is run during the current outbreak? Because surely you have to be doing the trial in people who have the disease.
Of course you do. And so the traditional route for any new drug, once it's been shown to be effective in animals, which this drug has, the next step then normally would be what we call phase one trials, where the drug is given in small doses to healthy volunteers to check it doesn't cause any side effects. Then we move on to phase two trials, where we use it maybe in people who have the disease, and we use a range of different doses to see which dose appears to be tolerated. And finally, we do stage three trials, which are the really important ones that say, does this drug actually make a difference in this disease? Now, the problem here with something like this Ebola outbreak is we can't really afford the niceties of going through all the stage one and stage two trials. And indeed, one of the ethical issues is, are they relevant? You know, let's take this ZMapp drug. So if that's given to healthy volunteers and causes a bit of fever and a bit of headache, well, does that really matter? I think the answer is no, because you're not going to be giving it to people who are healthy. You're going to be giving it to people who are dying of Ebola. And, you know, a bit of fever and headache is the last of their worries. And so we really need to, I think, relook at the way we assess drugs and assess them appropriately for the context. So what potentially we could be doing here is looking at the best available drug options, which may be ZMAP, but it may not necessarily be, and saying, okay, let's rapidly accelerate and set up a clinical trial in West Africa to see if it will actually make a difference. And then we'll know which drug we should be taking forwards.
Is there actually enough of this drug around? Because we've heard people in the media talking about there being only, say, 20 doses of ZMAP, and that's obviously not going to be anything like enough to do a decent trial.
Yes, there, as we understand it, there's about 20 doses around. But I think people are a bit fixated on ZMAP, if you like, because that's just the one that people have happened to have got hold of and given. But there's a whole range of other potential treatments in development, some of which have got as far as animal models, including looking at small interfering RNAs. But what we need to do is assess which is the best treatment and take that forwards. But I think another really important point is that, you know, rather sadly, we have been in this situation before where people have used experimental treatments in an outbreak, but then haven't taken it forward. So in the 1990s, people were treated with blood transfusions from patients that had survived. So as you probably know, if you survive an infection, if you survive Ebola, then your blood is full of antibodies which can act against the virus. And so in 1999, blood was taken from survivors and given to patients. It was given to 8 patients, 7 of whom survived, which again looks very promising, although, you know, it's not completely conclusive. So really what the next step then is to say, right, well, let's look at this in a clinical trial where we give it to patients, half of them get placebo, half of them get the drug, and then we'll know whether it really is effective. And for me, the sad thing is that, you know, we've had these kind of opportunities before, but as a community, as a medical and scientific community, we've not seized them and said, right, what's the next step now to really answer the question? And that's what I am hopeful the WHO will support in their meeting this week. And then maybe we can take these drugs forward. But of course, the key decisions will need to be made by the African governments.
Tom, we've got some questions in the room here. Nicola, what did you want to ask?
Is there a sense that, you know, this is a desperate situation over there? It's really, you know, just unbelievable. Is there a feeling that, you know, to do a clinical trial, you'll have to have controls who don't get given the drugs in order to test how effective they are? How, you know, yeah. Is there a feeling there that, you know, you would... there'd be some unhappiness about denying some people the drugs which could save their lives in such drastic situations, you know, for the sake of this clinical trial? Is that
think,
also one of
yes,
the
yes, I mean,
issues?
I think, Nicola, you've picked up on one of the really important ethical issues that the WHO will be thinking about this week, because, you know, opinions vary. And sometimes people think things are so desperate that you should just give the drug to everybody. Others will feel a bit differently. I mean, I'm an academic. I'm director of Liverpool's Institute of Infection and Global Health. We do a lot of clinical trials in a whole range of circumstances. And personally, my caution and my anxiety about just giving the drug to everybody is that at the end of the day, what will you know? You know, the outcome is currently 60%. It might change to 55%. So did the drug save lives or not? And of course, the other thing to remember is no drug is absolutely safe. There's always the possibility that the drug actually might make things worse. Mm. So again, would you be happy just giving a drug, even this ZMAP drug, to lots of people when you've no idea? So I personally, I always feel that we are beholden to try to get the information to answer the question. There are clever ways you can do clinical trials that do make a drug available to people who... because I can understand you would feel there are difficult ethical issues where, you know, half the people are getting the drug, the other are getting placebo, and then to watch those placebo recipients die would be very difficult. Mm. But we've done clever clinical trials, if you like, where you set an endpoint that allows you to look for deterioration. So, for example, you might say we're going to randomize to drug or to placebo, and then we're going to look for the critical markers that a patient really is getting worse. And for Ebola, that might be a critical change, a drop in blood pressure, or it might be a critical acid-base balance point. You know, because there are points at which you realize this patient now is extremely likely to die.
Yep.
And then that might be the point where you say, okay, well, that is going to be our end point. If one of these patients reaches that point, at that point, we then just, well, we can either unblind for them, Or even we just say, we're not going to unblind it, but this person has reached this endpoint, so we will now definitely give them the drug.
Yeah.
It may be that initially they got the drug, it may be initially they got placebo. Now we'll definitely give them the drug because, you know, it really is last-ditch effort for them.
And
this is somebody who clearly looks like they're dying, and so we will give the drug because, if you like, at that point it is on a compassionate basis. We don't know if it'll make them better. We don't even know it'll make them worse, but we think there's nothing to lose.
And one of the other questions I had here was, you know, how much is this a war against misinformation? You know, there's a lot of sort of issues around getting the right information about what the disease, or what the virus actually is, and what it's doing, and how to contain it. You know, how important is that side of things?
Well, I'm glad you've raised that. I mean, up till now we've talked about the ethical issues around novel treatments, because, you know, that's something WHO is exploring, but there are also many other much more important issues to think about. And what we know about Ebola is that we can get outbreaks under control. It's not going to be brought under control by doing clinical trials of new drugs. Mm-hmm. It's going to be brought under control by applying what we already know, which is that we have to educate people. Communities have to understand about the disease. They have to understand that if they get the symptoms, rather than fleeing, which is what has been happening, they need to go and get medical help, because the medics can provide treatment. They can provide simple fluid treatment that may save their lives. And also the medics will help isolate them so that they don't pass the disease on to their families and loved ones and other carers. So those are really important messages, because we know that those things work. And in fact, last week we had the announcement from the WHO of the public health emergency of international concern. So that means they've elevated the status of this disease and said, yes, this really is a major international health problem. And the recommendations that they make are very much along those lines, about education and about protection and about local measures to bring the disease under control.
Jessica, you had a question for Tom as well.
Yeah, hi Tom. One of the ethical criticisms is that that's been raised with this is that there's, you know, been 900 deaths in West Africa since February, but yet there's two US medical workers got that vaccine. What's the sort of feeling among the researchers and medical community working on this about who would justify the treatment? And I understand there's lots of issues about informed consent, and it's probably easier to get that from those US workers than it is from African communities, where
yeah.
I'm guessing as well there's probably a lot of cultural issues around the suspicion of Western medicine.
I think you're right. It was so two Americans have been given not the vaccine but the treatment, this new treatment, and there's been discussion particularly on the internet, in the Twitter sphere, about this, and you know, was it fair that Americans got the drugs when Africans didn't? But I think those who write those kind of comments perhaps don't really fully understand the issues. I mean, we've just described how hard it is to get African villages to accept the standard medical care, which we know will definitely save lives. You know, we're struggling to do that. So can you imagine then if on top of that you actually started testing a drug on people, that you potentially, and you know, it would need real explanation in the community, real endorsement, the sort of things we're now seeing, because otherwise you risk the accusation that you're just using Westerners using Western Africans as guinea pigs. And you know, we've seen these kind of accusations in the past during some of the big earlier HIV studies which were done in Africa, and then there were accusations, oh well, you're just trying out the drug here because it's cheaper, and then you'll be using it in the West. It's cheaper to do a study in Africa. Of course, you know, the ideal clinical study is on people who need the drug in the setting.
Finally, Tom, before I let you go, tell us what's happening on the UK preparedness front. You're involved with that as well.
Yeah, so through my role as Director of the Health Protection Research Unit in Emerging Infections, I'm involved in some of the questions around UK preparedness, but also I actually sit on the imported fever service. So this is something we've had running for many years now. And anyone who comes to the UK with a fever from overseas, if the diagnosis is not immediately obvious, if it's not malaria or bacterial infection, then we have procedures in place so that we get the right diagnostic test done in a timely manner. And so people are tested for Ebola and have been tested for Ebola for many years, occasional returning travellers. Thankfully, none has tested positive so far. Now, obviously, with the recent outbreak, these measures are being brought into use more frequently. But we would hope that if it does happen that a traveller gets on a plane and arrives in the UK with Ebola, then we would be onto it quite quickly. The important thing is that anyone who feels unwell goes and gets medical help. and that they let the carers know where they've been and what they're concerned about, and the tests will be done. And then if they are diagnosed as being positive, or indeed even whilst waiting for the diagnosis, if the concerns are high enough, they will be kept in an isolation facility to protect them and to protect people around them.
What actually happens on the ground, though? Do you get a memo sent around the guys at passport control saying, look out for people who are sort of, you know, bleeding and vomiting? Or like, seriously, but what actually happens on the ground to make a difference?
The way it works up till now on the ground is it's up to, the trigger point is for people feeling unwell. So it's up to somebody who feels unwell to consult medical help. Now, if it happens during a flight, or if the air crews are concerned, then they also can similarly let people know. And in fact, this is part of the advice that came from the WHO announcement last week, that we need to be a bit more thoughtful about how we advise air crews about what they need to do. And so I think airports will probably up their procedures. I mean, these procedures are all in place, but I think it'll be a matter of thinking about the actual scenarios. Okay, what would actually happen? But so essentially, it's nothing completely new. It's just really making sure that what we do well.
Tom, thanks so much for joining us on Science Weekly. How do our listeners keep up with your work at the university?
Well, if people want to keep up to date with the debate about Ebola and all the various issues that are coming from it, my Twitter hashtag, which is @runningmadprof, we put out a lot of tweets on that. So if people want to follow that, they can keep up to speed with our work on Ebola and also all the other things that we're doing at the University of Liverpool's Institute of Infection and Global Health, which of course has its own website too.
Wonderful stuff. Tom, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, okay.
From experimental drugs to over-the-counter drugs, and a report released days ago that claims a daily dose of aspirin can reduce the risk of stomach, prostate, esophageal and colorectal cancer. Nishad, you joined The Guardian's health correspondent Sarah Bosley when the team at Queen Mary University in London announced their findings. What were they saying?
Well, they actually were recommending for people to take aspirin from the age of 50 to 64, providing they've consulted their doctor. I should really state that. But yes, for them to take aspirin on a daily basis, a low dose, a 75 milligram low dose, and that would hopefully help them to prevent cancers.
So how big a deal is this? I mean, what sort of effects are they seeing in people who are taking low-dose cancer for long periods of time?
This is actually a review of many studies done over a long period of time, and what they found is digestive cancers in particular have been reduced by taking the aspirin. Cancers such as digestive cancers such as colorectal, throat and stomach cancers in particular have been reduced by taking aspirin daily. Other cancers though, such as prostate, breast, and there's another one which I can't quite think of at the moment,
lung
cancer, have also been reduced, but not to as great an effect. They're more along the lines of about 10% reduction, roughly. The others are more along the lines of about 30% reduction in both incidence and mortality.
So if there's anything in this is a potentially a huge deal, presumably, looking at, you know, the disease burden of cancer in the country and everywhere. I mean, the idea that you'd be able to prevent 30% of certain types of cancer seems quite remarkable for a drug that's been kicking around for decades, is off patent and extremely cheap.
Well, yeah, no, it's absolutely a big deal, because up until now, they've never been so very clear. They really put their names on the line, because the advice wasn't, oh, maybe you should take this. They were very clear with what their recommendations were. The actual researchers clearly stated that they felt everyone from 50 to 64, unless they have an underlying condition, should be taking aspirin on a daily basis.
And you touch on something there. I mean, all drugs have side effects. What are the downsides of taking low-dose aspirin every day for yonks?
Well, aspirin is a blood thinner. Basically, it causes the platelets, which are little cells in our bloodstream. So aspirin actually prevents them from being so sticky. So if you do have some form of a cut and you suffer from deficiency in platelets or such, it may not be a good idea for you to be taking aspirin.
Presumably, if you're at risk of having the kinds of strokes that are caused by bleeds in the brain rather than blockages in the brain as well, those are going to be more serious if you're on blood thinners, essentially, with aspirin rather than not.
Aspirin itself gives you conditions like peptic ulcers as well. So it causes conditions as well as sometimes exacerbating others.
Do they know how aspirin is having an anti-cancer effect?
There are two methods that they think it might possibly work by, two mechanisms. There are other mechanisms, I should say, but these are the most likely. The first is, as I mentioned earlier, aspirin thins blood and it basically deactivates platelets, their function. So cancer has been thought to spread around the body by hiding, being chaperoned by these platelets. So what aspirin does by deactivating these platelets, it means that the cancer can no longer attach itself, and so it cannot go through the body. And
so if the platelets aren't as sticky as they are, then the cancer cells can't get a trip around the body by sticking onto them, so you get metastases and so on.
Exactly that.
But the other thing is to do with inflammation, I think, because aspirin reduces inflammation.
One of the big signs for cancer is inflammation. Whenever something in our body is inflamed, our cells divide, new cells are created, and when they do this, there is a chance for mutation. And so if you can prevent the inflammation or at least reduce it, which is something that aspirin does, you can reduce the chances of cancer.
Right, who's going to be taking it when they're 50? Anyone?
I think...
Just withering looks all around. Withering looks all around. Is it a duck or is it a comet? Last week, the Rosetta mission reached its intended destination, Comet 67P Churyumov-Gerasimenko. I may have pronounced that badly and wrongly. This is surely the European Space Agency's most ambitious mission to date. And to find out just how pleased they are, we spoke to Matt Taylor, a project scientist on the Rosetta mission.
Well, this is one of the fundamental milestones of the mission. The mission is designed to rendezvous and escort a comet around the sun. And so, yeah, we've hit that first one right on the head. So it was a great day yesterday, a real success.
It's been quite some time to get to this point. How long have you been chasing this comet now?
A little over 10 years. And it's the culmination of a lot of effort. And it was good to see that we got to this stage yesterday.
Where's all this happening? Give us an idea of how far away it's happening, how far away Rosetta is, the main spacecraft is away from the comet now.
Well, it's only within 100 kilometres now. If we remember back to earlier this year when we came out of hibernation, it was a good few million miles away from the comet. And we were travelling about 800 metres a second with respect to the comet at that point. So we had to get rid of that velocity, that speed. And so we went through a series of 10 manoeuvres, and yesterday we had one of the final manoeuvres to bring us down to less than about a metre a second. So we're now at walking pace with the comet.
So is Rosetta going around the comet yet, or what?
At the moment, I would say it's most accurate to describe that it's escorting the comet around the sun. So it's basically in the same orbit around the sun as the comet, but technically it has these what they call hyperbolic orbits at the moment. It's kind of buzzing around about 100 kilometers away from it. It's not in a classical orbit that you see you'd see around the Earth or the Moon, etc. It's not yet close enough to get into what we call a bound orbit, a gravitationally bound orbit. That will be a bit later on once, I'd say about end of August, September time, once we start, no, actually a bit longer than that, more October time, when we start to really get into, we have to get in within about 30 kilometres of the comet before we can get a classically bound orbit.
So how far away is the comet and Rosetta now? I mean, they're both hurtling sort of towards the sun at the moment, but how far away are they?
They are at this moment, hang on a minute, it depends where we're coming from. So we're talking about 2.5 or so astronomical units, which off the top of my head is about 400 million miles away, something like that. I think that's right off the top of my head. Yeah, that's okay. About right, yeah.
We saw some pretty amazing imagery come through from Rosetta at the moment that it sort of hooked up with, it caught up with the comet. What did they mean to you? What do they tell you? What are you seeing in those images?
Well, every time we get a new piece of data come down, and I think it was shown yesterday that it's not easy even to get data that quickly. It's not like, you know, an HDMI TV that you're getting this fantastic images, you know, so many per second. It takes a long time to get this data. So we have to be patient, and we get this, we've had this stepwise approach. It's growing in pixels, you know, I think most people will recognise that there was this sudden surprise that it looked like a duck. So that was fantastic. Now it's turning into a very ugly duckling, to be honest with you, with these very, very alien features about it. So every time we get the newest image, and in particular yesterday, a full frame image, it's just phenomenal. This alien landscape and this environment that we're going to get very familiar with in over a year now. You know, we're going to spend all this time at ringside, front row, watching how this thing evolves. So it's just phenomenal to see these images coming.
Take us through what happens next. You're going to move into a bound orbit in several weeks' time.
Yeah.
But then what happens through the year?
Well, basically what we're doing now, we're doing this stepwise approach, as it were. We're gradually moving towards the comet to make sure we get a good idea of the gravity of the comet and how to fly around the thing. We'll get into a bound orbit, as I say, within about 30 kilometres, get a much better idea of how to fly around the comet. At the same time, from now all the way through these months, we are taking measurements of the nucleus, get an idea of the surface structure, the morphology, also temperature maps, and get an idea of what the composition of the surface is, because we're now immediately starting off the process of selecting a landing site for November when we deploy a lander. So that's a fundamental task that we have now, as well as beginning science. We've started this escort where we can characterize this nucleus now when it's relatively inert. It has activity, but it's not a massive amount of activity. And that sets the bar. That sets the bar for the rest of the mission, right the way through to the end of next year, because we're going to watch this thing grow in intensity in terms of activity right the way through perihelion, closest approach to the sun next year in summer, where it's going to have tons of material flying around from the surface, dust, gas, to form this coma, the outer atmosphere and the tail. And we'll see that happen. We'll see how that is created from surface features. This is one of the things that we see now. We'll see these very strange surface features and possibly be able to associate those with particular regions of enhanced activity within the environment of the comet.
So you want to get your lander down onto the surface before it gets too active, right?
Yeah, I mean, this is actually why there's such a very, very tight schedule. It's actually a hugely difficult task in the next few months to make these measurements, to come to decisions, to be able to process all of this information in such a tight timescale before November. Anything later than November becomes challenging in terms of being able to get it down on a more active comet. So we're on the rails now, and we're doing well, though.
The shape of the comet is pretty extraordinary. You've got this sort of... it looks like two bits that have either been pushed together or almost pulled apart. There's this sort of strong, there's this neck in between, sort of a smaller bulbous bit and then this large bulbous bit. And I think the whole thing is about the size of Mont Blanc. I mean, it looks, and I know nothing about this obviously, but it looks a bit tough to land on.
Well, as was shown yesterday, we still have hope that we're going to do this. I'm pretty confident that we'll be able to do it. It's more of a challenge. I think one of the things to pull out of this, from what we've seen from the surface features, and when we compare to previous missions to other comets that have only been able to provide us with a snapshot, a lot of the community, the cometary community, planetary specialists, are picking out various regions on this comet and saying, oh, that looks like this comet. Oh, this looks like this other comet. We've chosen a great comet. This is a really interesting comet because it's got features combined from all of these other comets. So yeah, it's got surface features from everything. So we've got a vast variety of targets in it, as it were. It's an interesting shape. It's a challenging shape. It will mean that certain areas we cannot land on, purely driven by illumination conditions. There are certain areas we can't put the lander down because it won't have enough sunlight, so we won't go in the shadowy region. But there is certainly quite a number of already pre-selected or possible identified sites that we could go and land on. This was presented yesterday during one of the press conferences to show that there's a number of places that we can go for.
And you need to land where there's enough sunlight because the lander is solar powered itself, right?
Yeah, we have to land somewhere that has the sufficient illumination by the sun, purely driven, as you say, by the fact that the lander has some batteries and has to rely on solar energy to recharge these batteries.
What do you hope to learn from studying a comet, full stop?
Comets are a window into the past, basically. These are the frozen relics of the beginning of the solar system. So when the solar system formed, when the planets were formed, they come from that time, and they've been thrown out into very deep space outside of the solar system in deep freeze. So the material they hold is relatively pristine compared to the processes that have gone on planets and even asteroids. So that stuff's been quite heavily processed, whereas the comets are coming in with reasonably fresh material. By analyzing them, we get a very good idea of what the conditions were during that early phase of the solar system. We can work out where the comet came from, and it's just that time capsule aspect that's so fascinating for us scientifically. In addition, we talk of them as dirty ice balls or snowballs or whatever, basically indicating that they are predominantly made of water ice, different sorts of ice with other gases captured inside them. When we look at the early Earth during planetary formation and solar system evolution, we want to know how water got to the Earth, why we're here, in fact. We're made of water predominantly. So we're going to look at that, the ice that we find, the water that we find on the comet, and compare it to the water that we find on Earth. We already know from ESA's Herschel mission that for a particular class of comet, they have a similar type of water, but we're actually looking at different isotopes of hydrogen, to that that we find on Earth. And so this is a similar comet to the one that Herschel had been looking at. So we're really looking forward to trying to get a bit more information out of that association.
Finally, Matt, I'm interested in what happens to Rosetta, the mothership, if you like, and the lander, which I believe is going to sort of harpoon itself to the comet. What happens to them once they've gone around the sun and they start heading back out towards this sort of the deep solar system, out towards Jupiter and so on?
Once we've deployed the lander, Philae, in November, it hopefully will last up until about March next year. Beyond that time, it gets to... there are problems from a temperature perspective. You think one of the challenges of the mission and also in space in general is trying to have components that can last or can cope with a variety of temperature differentials. So this was designed to go into deep space and be very cold, but now it has to get to a region which might become quite hot and quite torturous for certain components. So it will only last up until about March, given everything is going well. So that's the kind of lifetime we're looking for that. The orbiter will last at least up until the end of next year, and it's really that's driven by how much fuel we have on board. And that will then just go out and travel in the same orbit as the comet once the mission ends and have this little lander stuck to it.
Matt Taylor, thanks for joining us on Science Weekly, and good luck with the rest of the mission.
Thanks very much.
So, how to design a harpoon to go into a comet? And he said, well, the thing is, we don't actually know what it's going to be like. So we've designed it so that it will stick into something as hard as a table or something as soft as snow, because that's the range that they have to take into account. Mm-hmm. Because they just no idea, they'll know what the composition is, but they don't know what the porosity will be like and all this sort of thing. And the other thing I love about this is that, so the lander will try and land, and I don't think it's a done deal that they'll be able to land, because it couldn't be a tougher shape to land on. But it will harpoon on and then cling on and still be working round through till March next year. But then the electronics on board, it will start getting too hot and stop working, but it will still be latched onto the comet. And I was chatting to the scientist behind this, and he was saying that although it will be kind of dead, it will still be stuck onto the comet. And it once it goes past the sun through its perihelion, it carries on out towards Jupiter and past the orbit of Jupiter, something like 800 million kilometers away, before it then loops back round on this 6.5-mile incredibly elliptical orbit. And it might, every time it comes nearer the sun, obviously it becomes active, it produces this gorgeous long tail, and shed loads of dust and ice start spewing off it, you know, to create that tail. So it's kind of sticking onto this thing, which is eroding and abrading as it goes through space. And it said it might last a couple of laps around the sun, depending on how much material ablates away, kind of thing, as it goes around, before it finally just falls off. And they've no idea where it's going to fall off, but it's then just going to go off tangentially into space, this tiny little box of electronics with legs with a harpoon dangling from it. It's just going to be off. And I love that. It's an amazing mission. And Matt Taylor was absolutely right, I think, when he called it the sexiest space mission around at the moment.
Could I just add, it's an ESA mission, European Space Mission. And
not
that,
NASA.
Exactly. And for me, this is a massive thing. In fact, just for UK, it's the biggest thing, because we're so used to seeing those, you know, everyone, as you said, clapping their hands for over a big mission going right. And it's always NASA.
Yeah.
And yeah, we've got something now, something that no one else actually had an involvement in. It's great collaborating with everyone. But
there was a fabulously European celebration when they drew up alongside the comet, where there was just this sort of two people clapping. It was like, that's such a European way of celebrating. It's just like, yeah, we knew that was going to happen. Well done, we're there. Anyway, lovely mission. Thanks, guys, for joining us in the pod this week. We'll see you next week, I hope. Thanks again.
Support for this podcast comes from Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes creating a professional website for your business, personal brand, or portfolio so easy it's newsworthy. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
Armin Loire is an author, broadcaster, and professor of evolutionary developmental biology at Imperial College London. His latest book goes back to the very foundations of science and Loire's passion for the works of the Greek philosopher and thinker Aristotle. Titled The Lagoon, How Aristotle Invented Science, the book explores the effect of the philosopher's self-imposed exile from Athens and why over time he's been seen as the father of modern science. I met up with Armin to find out more.
So around 345 BC, Aristotle left Athens and went across the Eastern Aegean to a little town called Assos, which is now in modern-day Turkey, on the coast. It's a very beautiful place. And there was a prince there, a tyrant, Hermias, where he stayed, and there was sort of like a mini academy there. So Aristotle was there with some of his philosophical chums. Now, Assos is separated from the island of Lesbos by just a few kilometers. You can see Lesbos just looming there on the horizon. And it seems that he went there. He crossed over. He was newly married. It's possible, it's probable, that his wife was very young. He was 39 or so. She was 18. We don't actually know that except for the fact that he says the best age for a man to marry is 39. The best age for a woman to marry is 18. This is just one of those things he asserts. And since he was 39, we infer anyway. So Aristotle's thinking about biology. He crosses over to Mytilene, and which is the capital of Lesbos, and then he must have spent some time at this lagoon, which is this vast body of water, 22 kilometers long, 10 wide, which bisects the island. It's just its biggest, most obvious geographical feature, and it's the center of its fisheries, and it was rich, surrounded by rich towns. And Aristotle talks about the lagoon and its creatures quite a lot. He never says, I was here, but he speaks about them so much that scholars have long believed that that's where he began his biology.
He studied this huge breadth of subjects. If you look up anything on Aristotle, he commented on all manner of things that we will now consider in the realm of science. And interested in what areas you think he made the most impact, even at the time, even if those ideas didn't survive through to today. And I know he started off, as you were talking about, he did an awful lot of work on dissecting animals and things like that and looking at how they were working. Where do you think he made his biggest impact?
In judging when he made his biggest impact, you'd really have to specify the time frame. So I think in his day, actually, it was his physics which had an enormous impact, his theory of motion, and closely tied to that, his account of the cosmos and the physical world, and so on. His biology had relatively little impact. That is to say, when in the following century, in Alexandria, there's a flourishing of science, or proto-science, or early science, around the Library of Alexandria, there's all kind of science happening there, all sorts of engineering, a lot of it based upon Aristotelian ideas. But there's no biology. At least there's medicine, but there's nothing actually resembling the study of the natural world, in of living things. And so after this enormous flourishing, this enormous contribution that Aristotle made, it really goes silent for thousands of years until our own, until modern times. And that is when Aristotle's biology makes an enormous impact upon the founding of modern biology, even though his physics, his physical biology, his physical science is destroyed. And the destruction of Aristotle's physical science is, of course, the story of the scientific revolution.
Do we need to talk about what, whether this really was science that he was doing, whether he was doing more documenting an observation of nature, or was he actually testing theories and so on? So there's kind of a distinction between scientific method and what might be loosely called science.
The question of whether Aristotle was doing science or not is a very tricky one. You first have to tell me what science is. And, you know, you can talk forever about those things. Intuitively, in my heart, there's no doubt he's a scientist. I read his work, his biology, and it just speaks to me immediately. And the reason for that is because of a set of attitudes which he has. Part of it is, at its core, it's a desire to record the natural world. He believes in the factual reality of the natural world. He believes in the reliability of your senses. Unlike his teacher Plato, who believes that reality is really some world beyond the senses. Aristotle says, no, this is the world that we are interested in, the one which we can actually perceive. He says, there are facts that we can know about this world. So he's not some sort of epistemological relativist. That's very important. He's like scientists in that way.
Did anything come across in his writings which kind of nudges at this idea of evolution or of a puzzle there that evolution would be the answer to?
That's quite a difficult question to answer. And the reason it is for a modern scholar, especially a scientist, is that we are so conditioned, so imbued with the Darwinian spirit, as it were, that it's almost impossible for us to view the natural world, or even somebody writing about the natural world, without seeing the theory of evolution in it somewhere. And so people have been sort of hunting for proto-Darwinian thoughts in Aristotle forever, and others have said, there's nothing of the sort there. Aristotle is no evolutionist. That's very clear. He's not a creationist either. He's something else. He's an eternalist. And it's a point of view that we can hardly grasp, because for us, the debate is all between creation and evolution. But from Aristotle's point of view, so those two views are actually kind of similar, because they both have assumed that the world and everything in it and all the animals in it had a start at some point. Aristotle says, no, that's not the way it works. It's always been there. And it's, how long has it been there? When did it start? No. It's always been there, forever and forever and forever. And he has many philosophical proofs to show that this must be, in fact, be the case. Even so, despite the fact that that theory, just at its core metaphysical basis of that theory, precludes any kind of evolution. When you actually see him discussing creatures, you do see this tension in which is sort of a transformist tension. To give you an example, he speaks of seals as being crippled quadrupeds. That is to say, a seal has flippers, right? So it's got feet, but the kind of deformed feet. But wait a minute, how can a seal be deformed in any sense? I mean, after all, it's a creature living its own life, doing its own thing with its own features in any other way. It can only be deformed relative to something else, right? He says that snakes and lizards are kin. They're of the same family. And if you took a lizard and you stretched it out and you lost its legs, you'd get a snake. Well, that's true. But that account only makes sense in the light of a theory of evolution. And so you can see all these sorts of things. But I should say, Aristotle's not unique in this. In practically all pre-evolutionary writers, you can see them shifting towards evolutionary language, yet resisting the obvious implication, the implication that Darwin gave us.
Yeah. You were saying earlier that really it was the realm of physics where he may have made some of his most important breakthroughs. I wonder if you could take us through some of the things that he talked about there with the natures and so on that really shaped things in his time.
Aristotle's single most important contribution, and I think it is one that still stands, is that he gave us a way of explaining things, the elements of explanation, especially of complex things. Aristotle was not the first person to theorize about why things are in the world the way they are. There was a school of natural philosophers, Democritus, Empedocles, and so on, who had very elaborate theories. They didn't do any observations, as far as we can tell. It's all just talk about how the cosmos comes to be. And their theories are atomistic, and they're entirely what you could call materialistic in this sense, that they assume that the physical properties of matter are necessary and sufficient to give an account of the world as we see it. Aristotle says no. In fact, much of his career is devoted to demolishing their ideas. He says you need something else, especially you need something else when you're considering organisms. The brute properties of matter are not enough. And he says what you need is you need eidos, you need a form. This is a Platonic idea. Now, what exactly did he mean by this? Well, it all depends how you read Aristotle. If there are some people who say that Aristotle is appealing to some sort of mystical vitalist force, some sort of spirit that animates life and shapes raw matter, I don't. I think that the right way to read this is that Aristotle is grasping at the notion of information, and that he, although he apparently opposes the materialists, he is actually as much a materialist as a modern biologist is, in the sense that every biologist believes that raw matter is not sufficient to put together a creature, a complex entity. You need something else. You need information. You need information from your DNA. That's where it's encoded. Aristotle has an idea which is remarkably similar to this. And he has this idea that this form is embodied in the seminal fluid of parents, and that it shapes the embryo. And his entire theory of life springs from that.
And so he thought that that form that was somehow encoded in those seminal fluids was different for each of the different species. And so
that's exactly
what he knew about species.
Yes.
So he also taught Alexander the Great, though. What happened there?
So Aristotle is in Lesbos. We think happily cutting up fish, looking at snails. And he gets a call from Macedon, King Philip II. He knew Philip from when he himself was a boy, because this is the court, same court, different king, that he grew up at before he went to Athens. And Philip II calls him back to become tutor to his son. And here we have one of the most remarkable moments in history, where one of the greatest thinkers of all time has the whip hand over one of the greatest generals and leaders of all time. Aristotle taught Alexander, the man who would go on to conquer the known world. And we would love to know exactly what it is that Aristotle taught him, whether Aristotle made the man, or whether Aristotle tried to restrain the man in his genius, in his madness. And the truth is, we don't know. We do know, we have some letters that Aristotle may have written to Alexander, maybe authentic. We know that Alexander kept a copy of Aristotle's copy of the Iliad under his pillow as he rampaged across the East. But there is so much myth associated with it, with both Alexander and Aristotle, that it's almost impossible to know. If you take a really skeptical approach, then you're left up with absolutely nothing. There is a suggestion, it has been made, Pliny said so, that Alexander commanded the generals in his army to send the animals of the East to Aristotle for dissection, and that he even gave Aristotle loads of money and built a zoo for him. And it would be lovely to believe this, because Aristotle does know quite a lot about the animals of the East and in Africa, places where Alexander went. Unfortunately, it's hard to be actually pretty convinced about it, because most of what he knows about it is wrong. And so it's not at all clear that he's seeing these animals at actual firsthand, and he doesn't say anything about Alexander giving him any money or animals himself. It seems to be sort of a later accretion. It's a wonderful moment, but it's one we know little about.
And if that were true, then presumably the relationship between sort of leading scientists and political sort of national leaders has been going downhill ever since. I mean, you don't get that kind of influence going on anymore, right?
There's a suggestion that it wasn't even a terribly good one in his day. Aristotle does seem to know quite a lot about the animals in different worlds in the East, you know, elephants and so forth. But he doesn't know about them in much detail. It suggests that there was somebody with him, with Alexander's army, who reported back to Aristotle and gave him some facts about all those creatures, you know, tigers and so forth. And we have a suspicion who it was, namely one Callisthenes, who was Aristotle's nephew. And he was a natural philosopher in his own right and a historian, and went with the army to report back to Athens. it seems that somewhere in the East, Alexander, for various reasons, had the historian, Aristotle's nephew, arrested and executed in a particularly horrible way. It seems this was responsible for some of the cooling of relationships between Alexander and Aristotle late in life.
So, okay, things may have been worse for the scientific advisors of those days than they are perhaps today. Yes. I wanted to get on to one of the lovely things about, and it's not about trying to get any sense of superiority, but it is always nice to look at scientists' mistakes. And I was quite interested to see that, and you can tell me whether this is true or not, but I believe Aristotle thought that men had more teeth than women, but he certainly made some more sort of robust or well-characterized errors.
Yes, he did think that men had more teeth than women. He also thinks that humans have 8 pairs of ribs.
Yeah, how do you manage that?
I really don't know. I mean, even if we accept that he didn't dissect a human being, even if we accept that there was a taboo against dissection of humans in Athens at the time, you'd still think that he would come across a skeleton at some point.
Well, surely there were plenty of sort of malnourished slaves to look at, and you know.
Again, you would have thought so. And so, you sort of wonder, well, is this a mistake in the text? Did somebody else interpret this? But of course, if you begin blaming somebody else for every error in Aristotle's text, there's no end to it, really.
But the teeth as well. I mean, is there something, it suggests that to get those things wrong was either, I don't know, he had something else to do that afternoon when he was studying ribs or teeth, or that there was something sort of taboo about looking at the human body.
Yes. The one possibility is that it's the consequence of looking at fetal anatomy. So the one thing he does say is that he's very clear, because he describes it very accurately, is that he looked at aborted fetuses, not spontaneously aborted fetuses, miscarried fetuses. And it's possible that in the presence of a taboo against dissection, that's a taboo that did not apply to actual to embryos of fetuses. And so he took the opportunity there, and so he couldn't make out the number of ribs properly. I mean, I'm making excuses here, right? It is hard to know. But coming back to the question of mistakes that Aristotle made, the truth is that it's riddled with factual errors. And it's clear that part of the reason for that is because he's getting all the information that he can on this new subject, biology, the animal world, and he's filtering it as best he can. But there's a lot of nonsense out there. You can see exactly the same process in Darwin. A few years ago, I went to Patagonia in search of a tucutucu, which is a kind of little rodent-like creature, a vole-like creature, which Darwin assures us is blind and has very small eyes, and those eyes tend to be inflamed, because the thing lives underground anyway. There's a whole story about evolution of the loss of eyes, which he gives. I went to Patagonia. I searched this creature. I asked experts on it, zoologists. I asked gauchos who had seen it. And they said, it's nonsense. Tucutucus have perfectly good eyes. And one of them said to me, well, when we dig up the tucutucu, which lives underground, we have to hit it on the head. Maybe that's why, Senor Darwin's tucutucu didn't have very good eyes. So this is what I mean. When you're pulling stuff together, when you're studying a new field, you're bound to make errors, right? Aristotle was very much the big data man of his day. Big data always tends to be low quality data. Of course, in addition to that, those kind of minor errors, factual errors, he makes some big conceptual ones. And one of them is the theory of spontaneous generation. One of the great puzzles of Aristotle's biology is that he believes that many creatures are spontaneously generated. That is to say, they don't have parents, they just arise from inanimate stuff. And he thinks it's a pretty widespread phenomenon. Most insects, not all, are spontaneously generated. Moths are generated from clothes. Clams are generated from mud. It just goes on and on and on, right? It's got pages devoted to this. And it's a very strange theory. It's a strange theory in two ways. First of all, it seems inherently improbable. But of course, you can say, well, that's just us. We accept that every creature must have a parent. They just don't spontaneously generate. But it's actually strange from his point of view, too, because his entire theory, and this theory of biology, and this theory really does run down into metaphysical bedrock, is that stuff just can't assemble spontaneously. How is there order in the world? If you remember earlier, I said Aristotle, in contrast to the materialists like Empedocles and Democritus, said complex things just don't spontaneously assemble. You need information to do that. Eidos, form, right? Where does that come from? It comes from the parent's seminal fluid, right? The sperm, the eggs, right? Okay, well, that's the foundation of his biology. That's how you get embryogenesis. That's how you get a three-dimensional creature. That's how you get particular species. And he makes an enormous deal about this. I mean, his entire biology is predicated in this. And then he says, ah, well, but apart from those, you know, sometimes, actually, things can just assemble spontaneously without any source of order or form or eidos or anything like that. Yeah, they just pop out of mud. And, you know, to get that, really, it's not too complicated. You know, in fact, here's a recipe for an oyster. What you do is you get some mud of the right sort. You have a sort of a cavity, I guess an oyster-shaped cavity. You have some pneuma, which is a bit of a mysterious substance that he invokes. It's sort of like hot air. And you kind of just bake it there, and an oyster pops out, just like that. And it really isn't much more complicated than that. And scholars, including myself, have devoted a lot of ink trying to explain how Aristotle could have believed this theory and believed it quite sincerely, even though it flies in the face of what appears to be empirical evidence and his own elaborate theory.
Going through all of his works, as you've done for the book, and now looking back over the kind of achievements and the thinking that he did, is there anything that you'd say Aristotle has to teach us today, maybe scientists, maybe the rest of us?
Aristotle's work, I think, resonates with us today in a way that it does so much more so than in the past. It's true that every age rereads Aristotle and finds in it the things that they want to find and they need. And my own reading of Aristotle is very much of that sort. There's no doubt about it. We live in an age of systems biology, for example, of synthetic biology, in which we've actually to some degree ceased, in which the emphasis or the exciting part of science and biology has shifted away from the reductionist, cut it apart, dissect it apart analysis of individual cells, genes, proteins, and all that stuff, but rather putting it all together again, right? This is systems biology, synthetic biology, and so on. Aristotle's, that's the way he thinks. Well, that's the way I think he thinks. But of course, that may be just because of the way I think. But anyway, we can go on. I make the case that he is, in fact, the first systems biologist, because that his entire theory of biology really is about the interrelationship between parts, how the system works. And this is something that he calls the soul of the creature, which sounds terribly mysterious, but it is, in fact, the system. There's also the way he does science, I think, is a very modern science. I mentioned before that he's a big data man. Well, yes, this is the age of big data. So he doesn't do experiments. And of course, for a long time, Aristotle was much criticized for not doing experiments because we were all doing experiments. But we still do experiments, but we do a lot. What we also do now is we take up all the data going, we hoover it up, we crunch it down into numbers, into statistical models, and we infer models of how the world is from that. Well, in effect, that's what Aristotle is doing too. It's not statistics, and his numbers aren't as good as ours, but that's in effect what he's doing. He's serving the world for regularities, and he's accumulating all the data he gets, surveys the world, and then builds a model. And it's a kind of science which we are much more sympathetic today than we were even 50 years ago, I think. So that's important. But if I were to say, anyway, that's just recognizing in Aristotle ourselves, recognizing him as a reflection of ourselves. But if I would say the one thing which he gives us, and this is an eternal thing, is that he shows us by his example how to find new worlds. He says, if you really want to do something important, you can hack away at the problems of your predecessors. Or if you have a certain mentality, you can try to find a part of the world, preferably one that is beneath your nose, but that has just been ignored by everybody else. And if you do that, and begin with the simplest things, if you begin just accumulating the facts about it, sorting them out, looking for the explanations, you can do something wonderful and that will live forever. That, I think, is, but this is maybe just me, it's the thing that I take from him.
Armand Loire, thanks for coming on Science Weekly.
It's my pleasure.
A huge thanks to Armand there. His book, The Lagoon, How Aristotle Invented Science, is out now in all good on and offline bookshops. That's all for today. Remember, for breaking science news day or night, just go to theguardian.com/science. But from me, Ian Sample, and Science Weekly producer Jason Phipps, thanks for listening. Goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.